told the court he acted in self-defense, saying he believed the man breaking into his truck was armed.
This former Army man, he finds a guy rifling through his vehicle, and he shoots the guy. And he says, oh, well, he was in my truck with his hands up, not to surrender, but pointed at me. It was pitch black. He looked like he was literally about to shoot me, so I shot him. The guy in the car had a knife on his body, but no gun. I don't think you have to be a light-on-crime, bleeding-heart liberal to agree that there's a limit. Everyone has the same thing in their mind, like, I'm there with my family, my kids, and there's some crazed murderer, lunatic, drug addict breaks into my home, and I'm going to defend. Yes, you can defend yourself, but I think that reasonable people would agree with the law in any modern civilized nation that there's a limit to what you can do. It's not like on The Simpsons, the Cape Fear parody.
Now Sideshow Bob can't get in without me knowing. And once a man is in your home, anything you do to him is nice and legal.
Is that so? Oh, Flanders, won't you join me in my kitchen?
It doesn't work if you invite him.
So no, this is not Texas. You can't shoot someone just because they broke into your house. You can't murder someone who's not threatening you. Is this like a left versus right thing? Don't we all know this? After the break, we'll talk about why people are feeling less safe than before and why I might need a baseball bat next to my bed.
So it's funny you mention bleeding hearts. There's a lot of bleeding hearts that feel like right-wingers about this stuff. David Musgrave, noted socialist. One of my more right-wing opinions, and one that I think ought to be common sense, if someone breaks into your house, all bets should, as a rule, be off. He tweeted that the other day. I wasn't aware of this, Jesse. The sentiments I hear are that a lot of Canadians, you know, you talk about what's reasonable. Things aren't reasonable at 3 a.m. when you're awoken to someone with a weapon and your family's in threat. They're comfortable using more force than might be necessary to quell said attacker. We can get into the law. I spoke to this criminal lawyer about defense laws in Canada. But yeah, I think you'd be surprised how many people would be, the word isn't bloodlust, but you know what I mean, would be willing to go full bore to stop someone from potentially hurting their family, hurting them.
Here's the law. Canadians have the right to self-defend, protect themselves and their property within reason, so long as it's reasonable in the circumstance. So the law says that can include deadly force. Basically, it means that any defensive action should be proportionate to the threat faced. You can't shoot an unarmed person who punched you, for example. I can be sympathetic to the extent that, like, we don't take any chances. Like, somebody has broken into your home. You better make sure they're incapacitated. But you can't go medieval on them. You can't, like, tie them to a chair. And I can't believe this conversation. It's so silly. You know what makes it so silly is that it imagines that this happens all the time because it plays into people's fear. It becomes a proxy. Like, this thing about a person getting charged for defending themselves becomes a proxy for a larger culture war debate about regular Joe Canada trying to just defend his goddamn family from an increasingly crime-ridden hellhole country.
Gotham City.
Yeah, and our ridiculous backward socialist state is actually making him the bad guy. So it's a proxy for that, and I'm always skeptical of proxy issues because what are the specifics? What actually happened here? Are we facing some epidemic of breaking and entering? Are home invasions on the rise? According to Statistics Canada, breaking and entering has been on the decline for the past 10 years. The rate per 100,000 in the population, in 2014 it was 429 B&Es, and now it's 30% lower. And just over 2023, 2024, it went down another 10%. My suspicion, which the stats don't get into, is that a lot of these cases, maybe even most of them, is not this one that we imagine, where the super criminal intruder is there to do all sorts of damage to your children and wife and take all your things and burn the house down. But it's like your sister's ex-husband using his old keys and he's drunk and he's coming to take something back, or there's a domestic dispute. Like, how many of these cases, not to diminish them, but just to distinguish them from this kind of like archetypal fantasy of the home intruder, how many of these cases where somebody's home is broken into, is it broken into by someone you know? Right? And the notion that, like, anything you do now is nice and legal, I wonder about this.
I don't know. Let me play the other side. I have some sympathy for what is a sentiment that has been expressed to me, especially in urban centers, places like Toronto, which in the last few years, specifically after COVID, you feel less safe. You have daily contact with people who are in severe mental distress.
Mm-hmm.
Often those people don't have homes. Often they're suffering from drug abuse. In some cases, they're violent. The city feels more run down. Recently, there's been a dip in crime. There was nationally an increase in crime across Canada over the last few years. Recently, we've seen a dip. I'd be interested in seeing what the statistics look like in terms of B&Es and assaults specifically in Toronto.
It's interesting that you say that. I do have some stats here. And yeah, assaults in Toronto are up roughly 50% over the past 10 years.
In that cloud of worry about safety, there are people who feel like their only sanctuary is home. And they're worried about their families. And like I said, at 3 a.m., when someone's bursting down the doors, they are then primed to attack and to do more than what is considered reasonable in like a law classroom at University of Ottawa. So that's what I would just try to get people to think about.
I think that is a really good description of what is actually going on here. I think that maybe allows us to have a smarter conversation because that wider sense, it's not about, oh, I've been the victim of a crime increasingly.
And it's not fake. These people aren't imagining these things, Jesse. Like, you'll admit that when you come to work, like, it's different than 10 years ago when you're coming to work.
Absolutely. But let's actually talk about it because it's not that, oh, I've been burglarized so many more times than I used to, or I've been assaulted, or my home's been invaded. It's that a lot of people have a sense of insecurity and precariousness as they are watching something that they're watching neighborhoods deteriorate. They're watching people who are unhoused, people who have mental health issues. There's a huge drug problem. And when they see the public policy responses to this,
or lack thereof,
well, to the extent that there is a public policy response, is directed towards viewing these people as, oh, that person is sick, they're unwell, we need to respect them, they have as much right to be here as you do.
You're not the victim, they are.
Yeah, when that is what you're hearing from leadership, then people get into this sense of like, well, I'm going to defend my own damn self because this country's lost its damn mind.
In the U.S., they literally call it castle laws. This is my castle. If you're going to threaten me, I'm going to build a moat. And if you get inside, I'm going to have my said medieval weapon to take you out if you threaten
right.
my family.
But the moats are not really being, like the stats tell us that. That's not the actual problem. I'm sure there's outliers and exceptions to this. I'm sure that if you live in an area that has like severe drug problems and the crime is up in certain areas more than others. But statistically, on the whole, it's actually down. So let's just have a grown-up conversation where you don't have to pretend that the problem is that these people are in your bedroom. That's not the problem. It's okay to admit, and people should respect, it is a problem that the downtowns of Canadian cities are less safe, are not necessarily like appropriate places for children, are places that have a lot of people who are hurting in various ways, but are also affecting other people's freedoms and sense of safety and security. That can be a conversation that we could have in our newspapers, in the media, and in civil society. We don't have to pretend that we're all in bed with a shotgun. You know what I'm saying?
You're so optimistic that we can have these nuanced conversations. I guess I go in with less expectations that people are sane and can have sane conversations. A few months ago, I woke up at 2 a.m., and a gang of guys were going house to house trying to steal cars. Remember that huge rise in car thefts, which has no doubt contributed to this feeling of lack of safety. And someone had thrown a brick through my wife's sister's windshield, and they were stealing stuff, and stuff was strewn on the ground. That's like a ripple effect. That reverberated through our neighborhood. People are now on edge.
Yeah.
You know, people start buying baseball bats. And come on, every father in Ontario has a baseball bat beside their bed, whether they ever use
every
it.
Every father has a baseball bat.
You don't know?
Now I feel like I'm negligent in my duty. When there's a creek downstairs, I'm always reaching for some, like, I picked up like a
stuffy toy or something.
Yeah, I got nothing. This is going to help me. All right, I'll get my baseball bat. I think I'm complaining not so much because I find these news stories dumb and you know, it's an eye-rolling moment when everybody's sharing around a news story. Like, for all we know, I have no idea what happened, but
we don't know the details.
For all we know, this guy went ape with a knife on some guy who was just, like, rummaging through. Like, you know, like, we don't know the details, and everybody's relating to this guy in this way that's just pure projection. That is of limited annoyance. Big deal. I guess what irritates me the most is how quick people are to fall into these cliched roles of the tough-on-crime conservatives who kind of just speak in stereotypes and cliches. And then providing fodder to that is this, like, ridiculous rhetoric that comes from, like, social safety. Not that talking about social safety net is ridiculous rhetoric, but, like, it is possible for left-leaning leaders or for liberals to, like, address community issues, and that there is a difference between what it's been like for people who live in Canadian cities 10 years ago and today.
Well, Democrats are increasingly having to do this in the U.S. Places like San Francisco, you just can't avoid the fact that if you're a politician there and if you're on the left, you just have to confront, you know, these stores are being robbed constantly.
The Santa Clara County District Attorney is calling for a prison sentence for a group of men accused of leading an organized retail theft ring. The men pled guilty to more than 200 break-ins at Home Depots across the Bay Area.
A small clothing shop in San Francisco was broken into early this morning, and the store owners say the thieves got away with about $36,000 worth of merchandise.
They are caught on camera. They are literally ransacking a San Francisco Walgreens, and they don't even care that there is video of them. It shows how the city still has its work cut out for it, trying to clamp down on the kinds of brazen retail thefts that have gone viral.
There's, you know, public disruption.
It feels like Olivia Chow won't play anything but the central casting role. Like, it's impossible to get her just to regard a pretty legitimate concern here in Toronto that people have. And the only thing we could hear about is, like, what to do about these people and their problems, you know? And
the socio-determinants of health and how, yeah, this is...
And then Ford will play his role and we can't actually figure anything out.
Yes, that's a good point. And I think your point, Jesse, about the lack of response, seemingly, is a good one. You guys remember the police saying that you should leave your keys at the door?
To prevent the possibility of being attacked in your home, leave your fobs at your front door. Because they're breaking into your home to steal your car. They don't want anything else. A lot of them that they're arresting have guns on them, and they're not toy guns, they're real guns. They're loaded.
It's like leaving cookies for Santa, so that when the criminals come, they can just take it. This idea that the people are supposed to keep us safe have kind of given up, and you should cede ground to these criminals. Again, this is a feeling. This is the message that is sent. Then the response is, okay, if that police officer that's supposed to be going around my community make me safe is ceding that territory, I guess it's up to me to protect myself and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're left with. And yes, you pull that rhetoric from the conservative newsletter. You're going to get the craziest rhetoric there on all sides. They're going to be the most amped up.
And that's why I am the Batman. Harrison, we're going to duly note some stuff so people don't miss it. What do you have to duly note today?
I think this is somewhat important. So this is a headline. Yes, it's from our publication. No more burying our history. Burying? No more burying our history. The statues of Canada's prime ministers are out of hiding and back on display by J.D.M. Stewart. He's been teaching history for some 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the story of Wilmot, Ontario? Have you ever been to Wilmot?
I'm not sure that I have.
Wilmot, Ontario is near Waterloo.
Mm.
And it has been the home of a 12-year-plus history war. There was a project called the Prime Minister's Path where they were going to make statues of every Canadian prime minister. And initially it was going to be housed in Kitchener. It was rejected. Then it was going to be housed at the University of Laurier, literally named after a prime minister. Rejected. Finally, the fine people of Wilmot, Ontario say, we will be blessed for you to feature your art installation on our streets.
Oh, it'll be a blast. The kids could hang off of Diefenbaker's jowls.
And, and then what happens? The last few years happened. The McDonald's statue is vandalized. Council votes unanimously saying, we got to end this entire project, rip the statues up. We've had them all created and everything, but we can't deal, and we're going to put them into storage. What happened a few weeks ago? They have voted unanimously to reinstate all the statues.
They brought the statues back.
Yes. So what I see this potentially as is this a pendulum swinging in that we've still got, you know, Sir John A's in storage in Prince Edward County, Kingston, Victoria, Hamilton, Charlottetown. Are we going to come out of this finding that nuance we just talked about in that There will be plaques added to add historical context to what we now perceive to be misdeeds and bad things done by these guys. Are we going to have additional statues across from them, whether they be indigenous or otherwise? In this case, I think this is a bit much. They now have a separate path for Sir John A. So you must choose to visit Sir John A. Because God forbid, as you're walking your chihuahua, your gaze meets the brass eye of Sir John A. in Wilmot, Ontario. The Sir John A. at Queen's Park was unboxed. The gall of our politicians, whether they want to remove it or keep these statues, they sat on this stuff for 5+ years because they're b-less, and they'd rather just live in this weird period of stasis, not make a friggin' decision. At least finally, they've unboxed Sir John A. at Queen's Park and are actually going to do something about it. A conservative government, for God's sakes.
Can I come out again? No, John.
What do you think?
What I think about this has changed. What I used to think about this was that I didn't care. And I didn't understand why people like you got so worked up about it. Like, I just couldn't care less about honoring Canadian history and this narrative and these honorifics and like we had the decapitated head of John A. Macdonald as the Canada Land show artwork. Not a necessarily celebration of that decapitation, but it just felt like the right image for our company.
Yes, and we hated you for it. But now it's changed.
This is what I think now. My indifference to Canada's history is the indifference of somebody who was taught that history, who had the opportunity to, like, first of all, just learn factually how this country came to be. Even when I was taught it, I was not taught like a totally glorified picture of it. You know, there was some aspect of like post-colonial studies was creeping into the curriculum, you know. I had the ability to learn the myth, learn the facts, learn what was not true about it, and arrive at a position of like, I don't really care about this stuff. So when it became time for people to rip down statues, I said, okay, well, I don't really need John A. Macdonald, so why does anyone else? Where my view of this has adapted is other people are not being given the same education. I'm not going to speak in praise of mythology. Like, I want facts over mythology. But I think that when people come to Canada or when a child is raised in Canada, we have to teach them what this place is, what's good about it, how its existence does say something about the progress of the world, and what mistakes were made and what we're living with today and have to account for and reconcile for. But to simply vilify or put in a box or remove or demonize, people need stories. And either you're told a nasty...
Especially during trade wars, you know?
Yeah. Where's our nationalism when we need it? Like, what are we? What is this?
What's the point of all this?
What is the point of all this, Harrison? And I'm seeing that something will fill that space. And if there is no cogent story, a fact-based story, hopefully over a myth, people will fill it up with all sorts of other things. And it actually can lead to some really antisocial and corrosive aspects. I actually feel bad for young people. They're told a lot of nasty, negative shit about the country they live in. And I think that is just as reductive and sentimental and simple as celebrating it as, you know, some manifest destiny triumph. And I think that what I am starting to understand is that the importance of national narratives, I don't think we're equipping people with the information, forget about mythologies, but narrative information to understand who they are, what is good here, what matters here. It's like the choices being given are nihilism or nationalism. You
That's
know?
A good, can I mention, in the case of Wilmot, statues are not glorifying. They're not on plinths. They're not high above you. You're not looking up.
I don't have any problem with these statues existing. They can be conversation starters. I don't necessarily take the presence of a statue to be some glorification. It points to the past and maybe invites you to Google something. But I'll leave room here for the fact that there are people who may see a colonial oppressor cast in bronze and take harm from that. I think that that can be valid. When I'm traveling and I see a statue of somebody, I don't assume this is a great person. My assumption is if they're from the past, they probably did some nasty. But who was this? What is the story of this person? How did they become turned into a bronze statue and put in this park? It just links you to the past and makes you ask questions. Duly noted. I'd like to duly note some news from the protest movement. The protest movement at Fan Expo Canada. How do you even tell the story? This is from Bleeding Cool News. The cops were called into a huge nerdathon at Fan Expo Canada. Bell Canada had a big, flashy photo booth at this event. A lot of anime stuff, a lot of comic book stuff at this big convention. And here's Bell. They were making free AI-generated portraits of attendees. You come to this big, slick photo booth. It takes a picture of you, and the AI will turn you into an anime character. And this was a huge misstep for Bell because they were at the heart of creator culture. They put this big honkin' slick booth right next to Artists Alley, where goddamn actual cartoonists draw things with their hands. And here is Bell taking your picture and giving you an anime version of yourself. Well, this is a huge controversy within cartooning because what is the AI trained on? It is trained on work by actual artists. And there was a kind of like wildcat protest. Aaron Reynolds, a local webcomics guy, and other artists went and staged some kind of action against Bell. And the cops were called in.
I feel for the cartoonist.
I feel for the cartoonist, too. I am a failed and frustrated cartoonist myself. There's some, like, people who have just, like, such high-level skill, and they care very much about every little crosshatch, about the quality of their line, and I fear that ultimately they will lose this fight. My inclination is always towards, like, hey, tools for creativity are ultimately, first of all, unstoppable and inevitable. But they have a case. They have a point. All of the artists and illustrators and journalists and writers who are mad at AI, they've got anxiety and fear, but they also have like a legitimate position that their stuff is fueling this. And I think that ultimately the answer is that some sort of licensing regime where they get some kind of compensation. But this thing isn't going anywhere.
If you can't beat them, join them, especially on the journalistic side. They're trying to sue these AI companies. And if they're not trying to sue them, they're trying to get a bit of the loot. And we'll see what happens to both of those efforts. I'm not optimistic on either front. Duly noted.
That is our show for today. I hope you liked it. Harrison, where can people find you?
You can find me in the Twitter dump at Harrison Lohman.
Okay. Harrison also is an editor at The Hub. Check him out there. I can be reached at jesse@canadaland.com. You can email me. I read it. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Sharing music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.